This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with John Bellamy Foster about the ever-present and increasing climate disaster.
We're inspired to deal with this topic because of our guest's new book, Capitalism in the Anthropocene, Ecological Ruin or Ecological Revolution. We're also joined by constitutional author and scholar Stephen Rohde to discuss some cases before this term of the Supreme Court that many feel could mark the end of American democracy.
It's a reactionary Supreme Court, more powerful, some people think, than the other two branches of the government.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Time is running out for humanity to avoid a catastrophic planetary tipping point. The globalized system of capital accumulation has induced humanity to foul its own nest. The result is a planetary emergency that threatens all present and future generations and has thrown into question the continuation of civilization and ultimately the very survival of humanity itself. Only by addressing the social aspects of the current planetary environment is it possible to develop the ecological and social resources for a new journey of hope. The United Nations International Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, predicts that as a result of the increase in greenhouse gases, by the year 2050, there will be 1 billion climate refugees. Temperatures must be held within 1.5 Celsius increase. If it goes up, as predicted, an increase of 4% would end all civilization. The crisis we are now in is multiple: species extinction, ocean acidification, sea level rise, depletion of soil, forest fires, broiling heat waves, hurricanes, and drought have plagued us in the last few years. One third of Pakistan was underwater. We speak today with John Bellamy Foster. He's the editor of Monthly Review magazine and a professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Oregon. He has written many books, including The Robbery of Nature and The Return of Nature. His most recent book is Capitalism in the Anthropocene, Ecological Ruin or Ecological Revolution. John Bellamy Foster, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be here.
Why do you think time is running out for humanity to avoid a catastrophic planetary tipping point? Do you agree with George Monbiot that, quote, capitalism is leading us into a death spiral? Let's talk about what's going on, what we can do about it. After 1970, human activity took over from the geological processes which had affected the Earth and generated an existential crisis in the world's population. The latest IPCC report warns us of this. What's the IPCC, and what did that report say?
Well, it's interesting what the latest IPCC report, AR6, said. One of the reasons is that the third part of the report, the most important part on mitigation, was censored, in fact, rewritten from what the scientists said when the government entered in before the report was published. But if you look at the physical science part of the report, part one, they basically say that we are headed past 1.5 degrees increase in global average temperature, which is considered now to be the tipping point for massive climate change. We're headed past it, even in the most optimistic scenario. So in the most optimist scenario, we won't hit a 1.5 degrees increase in global average temperature until 2040, and then we will go up to a 1.6 degree increase, peaking at that, and then at the very end of the century, we'll get down below 1.5 degree increase to a 1.4 degree increase at the very end of the 21st century. But in the most optimistic scenario, we're facing now very extreme compound weather events that will dominate this century. It puts billions of people in jeopardy. But the bigger problem, of course, is stopping the fossil fuel emissions, the carbon emissions, before we go too far down the track. So we definitely want to try to stay on the below 1.5 degrees pathway, or well below 2 degrees, which is the second most optimistic scenario, or we're looking at absolute catastrophe. The next three scenarios are absolutely catastrophic, with the fifth scenario, which is what we really are on track for right now, would have a temperature increase of 4.4 degrees, the best estimate, which scientists say would be the end of industrial civilization. So we have to act very quickly. We only have a short period in which to act, and we need revolutionary scale transformations. Now, the third part of the AR6 report on mitigation, in the scientific consensus, which was developed by August 2021, in that report they explained that revolutionary scale change was necessary, that we had to go to low energy solutions and reduce demand. We had to restructure the economy. We need massive social movements to put all this in place. That the technological solutions that are propounded, like carbon capture and sequestration, are not there and can't save us from this problem, and so on. And all of these things were censored out of the published document. We know because the scientific consensus was leaked. The scientific consensus report was leaked. And we put it up on MR Online. It was leaked by Scientific Rebellion, which is part of Extinction Rebellion. And then the governments intervened, rewrote the whole summary for policymakers of the AR6 Part 3, and the published version downplayed all of this. It said that we could still expand coal plants, while the scientists had said we can't, and so on. So they're basically lying to us, and the problem is becoming much more severe. We need revolutionary scale transformations according to the science, and we're not doing that at present.
My goodness, government's lying to us. My goodness, be still my heart. I can't believe it. Ah, dear. You wrote that human activities are now, of course, the main force impacting the Earth as a whole, and what has generated an existential threat to the world. What caused this massive shift in the history of the Earth, from just sort of natural geological processes to the fact that it's the human activities? We've known about the approaching catastrophe, been upon us for half a century now, but the powers that be have still not done anything. Why is that the case? Those forces which are creating the crisis now, knowing full well they're doing so, nevertheless have done nothing of any real note to change it and to stop doing it.
Well, the short answer to both questions, what caused this and why we're not doing anything about it, is capitalism. This is the key. If we, you mentioned that anthropogenic factors are now the major drivers of Earth system change. This is how we define the Anthropocene epoch in geological history. In the history of the billions of years of history of the Earth, it's always been non-anthropogenic factors that have been the major drivers of the Earth system as a whole, of Earth system change. And now we have, really due to capitalism, we have now anthropogenic factors I mean, yeah, anthropogenic factors, that is, human factors. The human beings are the major driver of Earth system change. But it's not just human beings as such. It's the nature of our society. It's capitalism that is generating this, a system that demands constant increases in the accumulation of capital, exponential increases in the accumulation of capital, regardless of the effects on humanity and the Earth system. So we have a very extreme destructive system at play. Capitalism, in its early stages, can be seen as having been a force for the improvement of conditions of humanity, although it also was destructive. But it was a development over the feudal society that preceded it. But now capitalism has turned into a system. It's reached a point where it's destructive of our relation to the Earth. So we have a global habitability crisis. It's a crisis of the planet as a place of human habitation, and that's being destroyed at an accelerated rate, at a rate of now of years and decades, not centuries.
For those listeners who just tuned in, I'm Attorney Michael Smith. This is Law and Disorder. I'm here with my co-host, Attorney Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with John Bellamy Foster. John, talk about our fossil fuel capitalist economy worldwide and why it is so intractable to change.
Well, it's the fossil fuel economy, we call it fossil capital, is so intertwined with the capitalist system globally and with the financial system it almost requires the transformation of the entire system. It requires a radical transformation of capitalism and creating a new mode of production just to get beyond the emphasis on fossil fuels, the reliance on fossil fuels. That's the nature of the problem we have, so that although we've known this about this problem for over half a century, nothing really has been accomplished, and we're reaching the end of the line. And one of the they talk about the clean energy transition and alternative energies all the time, but we've made very, very little progress overall in that, at least in terms of the scale of the change that's required. And one of the reasons is that even though, let's say, solar energy is competitive with fossil fuels, the global infrastructure, the infrastructure, energy infrastructure, is a fossil fuel infrastructure. So we keep on building and subsidizing that fossil fuel infrastructure, which has been produced over centuries. And there is no solar or wind infrastructure that can compete with that. So we have to build an entirely different energy infrastructure at this point if we're going to keep our energy use at the same level. And the powers that be make more profits off of fossil fuels because of the existing infrastructure, and it is more profitable. The energy systems are not really on a level playing field. The other thing is that there are trillions of dollars on fossil fuel reserves. If we stopped producing or extracting fossil fuels, the oil companies and the financial capital, which have a lot of their assets in the form of these fossil fuel reserves, they would be imperiled by that because their assets would go away. The fossil fuel reserves that are below the ground are actually in play in the contemporary economy.
I wonder about, John, you know, we're all urged to recycle and to buy green, shop green, and to take a bicycle instead of a car, an electric car, and all the rest. and much is made of that, of course, and it may be of some great value, I don't know, but can technology alone, can those kinds of measures alone really solve the problem?
No, not according to the science. The science says that we don't have, well, I mean, simply by changing our consumption, something that you tell children right in the very beginning that they should, you know, we try to teach them about recycling and so on. Mm-hmm. And it certainly is important on a moral basis and in terms of individual action. But the only thing that can get us out of this is a major social transformation which requires political action. It can't be done by individual reductions in consumption. We have to get our we have to shift in terms of our energy consumption, but you're not going to get that on an individual basis and not on the level that's needed and with the speed that's needed. That requires political action and social transformation and going against the powers that be. For example, if everybody in the United States eliminated the waste coming out of their household, so there was no household waste at all, that would reduce the total amount of waste and produce ecological waste by 3%. The rest of it is all determined by the corporations. And on a level of consumption, we can't affect this. We have to affect it politically, where we change the production system, the mode of production.
We're speaking with John Bellamy Foster, the editor of the wonderful magazine Monthly Review. John, capital accumulation is the driving force of the system. Why is this so irrational?
The system is geared to capital accumulation. Capitalism, in essence, is a system of the accumulation of capital. That's what it's about. That's what it does. It's constantly trying to increase the capital in the hands of a relatively few individuals, and to expand the whole system in those terms. But it's an enormously destructive, wasteful, and inefficient system. Inefficient by ecological standards, by human standards, including human health. It's an incredibly wasteful and destructive system that really has only one end, and that's the accumulation of capital in the hands of the wealthy. And the benefits are supposed to trickle down to us, but they don't. And meanwhile, the system is destroying the Earth as a place of human habitation at a very, very rapid rate. What we are seeing is that the nature of the system and the expansion of the system are creating a situation where we are generating rifts, we could call them metabolic rifts, in the biogeochemical cycles of the entire planet. So we're crossing numerous planetary boundaries, including climate change, but also other boundaries like species extinction, which is 1,000 times now the background rate, and we're talking about losing half of all species, as much as half of all species this century. And we have disrupted the phosphorus and nitrogen cycles. Chemical pollution we've now crossed planetary boundaries on that. We are finding diminishing fresh water sources, and forests and ground cover are being destroyed. So we have these numerous planetary boundaries that we're crossing, and the cause of it, of all of it, the common denominator in all of this, these crises that are global ecological crises, is the expansion of the capitalist economic system, which leaves all of this out of account and simply is geared to the cash nexus.
This is Jim Lafferty, along with co-host Michael Smith, at the moment interviewing John Bellamy Foster, of course, the editor of Monthly Review. And John, the show today was really inspired by your new book, A Capitalism in the Anthropocene, Ecological Ruin or Ecological Revolution. To whom is the book addressed, aimed at, and what dominant questions does it raise?
Well, the important thing is, you know, the title, Capitalism in the Anthropocene, basically captures the two aspects of the crisis, the planetary crisis that we're in. Capitalism is really the cause of the crisis. It's ecological destruction. But we also have to understand that this is not the same as what came before, that we're in an entirely new period of history, and actually a new period of geological history, where in the past the system destroyed local environments and people could move on, but there was regional and local environmental destruction. But now, according to the science, the economic system, capitalism, to give it a name, is disrupting the biogeochemical cycles of the entire Earth system, and therefore jeopardizing all human life. We're talking about the reports are coming out of scientific studies indicate that we may have as many as a billion climate refugees by 2050. Certainly hundreds of millions, billions of people are already being threatened by what is happening. The consequences that are enormous. We saw this summer heat waves across the entire northern hemisphere, which were unprecedented, particularly in the high and middle latitudes. And this is a sign of what is going to come, and on an even bigger scale, if we can't restrain the system that we're in. So the two problems, you know, we now have capitalism, but we now have capitalism in the Anthropocene, an Anthropocene that the system has generated, but now threatens to overwhelm us all, because it means an Earth system that is in crisis, at least in terms of human habitability, in terms of the planet as a place for human habitation. And we can't get away from this unless we go against the political economic system and the mode of production that we've generated. I argue, and scientists Carl Soriano and myself and Brett Clark have argued, that we could call the new geological age of the Anthropocene as the Capitolinian age. This is the first age of the Anthropocene, is an Anthropocene crisis dominated by capitalism. We have to create a new geological age, which we call the communion, based on community, communal, and commons, and in which we have a sustainable relation to the Earth, a process of sustainable human development. We stabilize our relation to the Earth, but to do that, we have to go in a socialist direction, that is, towards a society based on substantive equality and ecological sustainability.
John, you've said and written that in America, three men own 60% of the country. Who are these three men, and what do you mean when you say that the power, therefore, has to be democratized, that the system of production needs to be reordered? You've said that the key is who owns and controls production. So talk to us about this.
Well, three men are what? Bezos, Bill Gates, and
Mr. Tesla, yeah.
Musk. Bezos, Gates, and Musk own as much wealth as the bottom 60% of the U.S. population. The economy is, and the society are geared to those hyper-capitalist interest to a billionaire class, as Bernie Sanders says, and to their hangers-on, and not towards the population as a whole. When I teach classes to my undergraduates, a lot of the students think that the system in the United States is democracy. I say, well, no, the system isn't democracy. The system is capitalism. And understanding that is key. That is our problem. That is what we have to confront. And the fact that we haven't been able to deal with any of these problems, we haven't been able to address them, that it gets worse and worse. The Inflation Reduction Act is a fraud, and the reason it gets worse and worse is because the nature of our system does not allow for the changes that are needed in order to protect humanity, in order for human survival, because the goal is one of institutionalized greed and accumulation of capital, and the population can go to the wall. Look at in Pakistan, a third of Pakistan was flooded, and this is a result of this system. It isn't democracy if you promote a political economic situation and ecological destruction that endangers the entire population of the earth. That can't be democracy.
John, unfortunately, we're running out of our allotted time, but I do want to ask you a couple of questions. I'm going to end up asking you, how can people contact you? How can people get your new book? But before I ask you that, I wanted to know, we cannot have massive ecological change without massive social change, of course. And the people of the USA, you've said, especially young people, they want change and they know this. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, change is coming no matter what. I mean, we're continuing to talk in a naive way where we separate the fundamental issues. We're talking here of the most massive changes in the entire history of humanity. And you know, these changes are coming upon us as a result of the nature of our social system. We're talking about, in this century, a situation where industrial civilization could come down. In fact, we're heading that way. In the time of in the lifespan of many people on Earth today, not very many decades ahead. And the time in which to act is now, the necessary time to act. But we're talking about the most massive changes that anybody has experienced. We're already seeing extreme weather events and compounded extreme weather events all over the Earth. And in the next years and decades, this is going to get worse. And if we don't stop it, it's going to be absolutely catastrophic. So, and political systems aren't going to be stable under these circumstances. Economic systems aren't going to be stable. If we don't decide to promote a socialist or eco-socialist answer to this, if we don't organize for peace and the environment and a socialist solution, we're going to see the growth of more war, fascism, on top of this deteriorating situation. There is no way in which people can stand still now. They have, there's no way that they can avoid major change. We simply have to decide how we're going to act. And we have to organize at this point for our communities, because the disasters are absolutely enormous, and they're hitting communities in the United States as well as the rest of the world, and we have to organize for the survival of people who are threatened by this. And we have to do it on a community and basis, on an egalitarian basis, in terms of eco-socialist principles, utilizing planning, putting people first before profits and the environment. We have to do this because we're faced with these disasters. And if we just stand still, and I think we can see that, we're going to have more and more wars over resources. We're going to see the most reactionary developments in political systems as they try to hold this together. And there'll be increasing likelihood of nuclear war. We either deal with the system and the problems it has generated, or we suffer the cost.
John Bellamy Foster, Jim and I want to thank you very, very much for being our guest on Law and Disorder. I want to remind our listeners that you've just come out with your new book, Capitalism in the Anthropocene, Ecological Ruin or Ecological Revolution, and also that you're the editor of the wonderful magazine. I've been reading it for 55 years. It's called Monthly Review, and people should get the book and subscribe to the magazine. And John, we really appreciate your being on the show.
Indeed we do, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
A recent New York Times article by David Leonhard titled, A Crisis Coming, The Two Twin Threats to American Democracy, Leonhard, after first identifying the first threat being that things are now in place where for the first time in U.S. history, a legitimately elected president will not be able to take office. He identifies the second threat as follows, and I quote, The second threat to democracy is chronic but also growing. The power to set government policy is becoming increasingly disconnected from public opinion. The run of Supreme Court decisions, both sweeping and, according to polls, unpopular, highlight this disconnect. Although the Democratic Party has won the popular vote in 7 of the past 8 elections, a Supreme Court dominated by Republican appointees seems poised to shape American politics for years, if not decades. And another headline in a recent edition of the New York Times reads as follows, 3 huge Supreme Court cases that could change America. And that article is simply one of many of late, warning of how the ever more conservative, indeed, one could say, reactionary Supreme Court, in its just opened fall term, may well change America, change it in a number of vastly different ways and ways inconsistent with the majority political views of the American people. Well, to help us understand this looming danger, I can think of really no better guest than ours today. Steve Rohde is the past chair of the American Civil Liberties Union of Foundation of Southern California. He is the founder and current chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace. He's a widely recognized expert on the U.S. Constitution as well as a political activist. He is a prolific author. His books include American Words of Freedom and the book Freedom of Assembly. He has written numerous book reviews and articles on civil liberties and constitutional law, and indeed his book reviews can be found frequently in the Los Angeles Review of Books. Steve Rohde, a warm welcome back to the Law and Disorder Show.
Thank you, Jim. It's such a pleasure to be with you.
Well, Steve, are you as concerned, as alarmed, really, as are many other constitutional experts and civil libertarians by what the Supreme Court, well, what it's done over the last year or so, this last term or so, and may well do during its just open fall term, what it may do to life and governance in America? And if you do share that concern, why is that?
I am, Jim. You know, in the founding period, Alexander Hamilton called the judiciary the least dangerous branch because it didn't have control over guns or the treasury. But I'm convinced, I think others like Lawrence Tribe and other commentators and constitutional law experts are convinced that this court is becoming the most dangerous branch of government, at least in terms of the issues it addresses and the interpretation of the Constitution. Last term, the six-member super-conservative majority implemented the conservative Republican playbook. It was anti-abortion, pro-gun, pro-church, and pro-business. And they did all of it by elevating a theory of originalism that Robert Bork and Justice Scalia tried for years to force on the court, and now there is this conservative group that believes the Constitution is frozen in the 18th century, and that's how it should be interpreted.
Steve, there are at least three key cases or issues now before the Supreme Court that have alarmed you and me and Jim and other constitutional scholars. Could you first talk about the Merrill versus Milligan case, which is a voting rights case?
This is a very important case. Briefly, the facts are pretty clear. Alabama imposed a congressional map that diluted the power of black voters in Alabama. 27% of Alabama's population is black, but only one out of seven congressional districts has a black majority. So a district court, three judges, unanimously found it was likely that this Section 2 of the Federal Voting Rights Act was violated, and it ordered the state to create a second black majority district. Before that case could even be briefed and argued, five Supreme Court justices stayed the ruling. In dissent were the three liberals, Kagan, Sotomayor, and Breyer, and Roberts. And they found there was no intent requirement, so that gerrymandering is going into effect in the fall elections next month. Now, this case was the first case argued on October 4, and the only glimmer of hope is the appearance of the new Supreme Court Justice, Ketanji Brown Jackson. She took a hold of this case. She was active in the oral arguments. She pressed the Attorney General of Alabama to explain why the Voting Rights Act didn't take race into consideration, since that was the very purpose of the act, which has been ratified and renewed by Congresses throughout the years. She pushed him hard. We have no idea what the court will do. I have a feeling Ketanji Brown Jackson is going to be a major force on this court.
Well, let's hope. Another, though, of the particularly worrisome cases is, of course, Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard, and a separate but related case by the same plaintiffs, Students for Fair Admissions versus University of North Carolina. Both are affirmative action cases. So talk to us, Steve, about the issue involved in these cases and why we should be alarmed by how the Supreme Court well, may likely rule in the cases.
These are very important cases when it comes to affirmative action and the lives of hundreds of thousands of students across the country. They involve a public university, North Carolina, and a private university, Harvard. Oral argument is set for October 31st. Unfortunately, Ketani Brown Jackson has recused herself because she previously served on the board of overseers at Harvard. What this case presents the possibility of turning back decades of law, settled law by the Supreme Court with justices across the political spectrum. Many will remember the Bakke case in 1976, holding that race may be considered as one factor in college admission. That was ratified and renewed in Rutter in 2003 and in Fisher in 2016. But the Fisher case had an ominous dissent from Roberts, Thomas, and Alito, challenging the entire question of whether affirmative action was constitutional. At stake here is, for a public university, is the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, which again takes race into consideration. And in a private college setting, Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act for recipients of federal funds cannot discriminate on the basis of race. Given these justices thrashing through precedent, ignoring stare decisis last term, I am very concerned about these cases.
This is Michael Smith. I'm with Attorney Jim Lafferty. We're speaking with our friend and colleague, Steve Rohde, constitutional scholar. Steve, the third case is Moore versus Harper, where the issue is partisan gerrymandering, in which government, the state government or the federal government, has the power over elections. Many experts believe this could prove to be the most important case now to be decided this term by the Supreme Court. Explain what's at stake here, please.
Yes, and I join in that view, not only for the election of congresspersons, but the election of our president. The North Carolina Supreme Court struck down a Republican redistricting map, which would probably have given two more Republican seats in Congress. They already have 10 out of 14 seats, even though the population is roughly 50-50. In March, the Supreme Court let that ruling stand, which is a good thing, because that gerrymandered map was struck down. But Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch dissented. What this case introduces, and it's a technical legal concept, but it's important for everybody to understand it, it's the independent state legislature theory. Under this theory, which was originally proposed by Justice Rehnquist in a concurring opinion back in Bush v. Gore, is that state legislatures have total authority to draw congressional maps and also choose electors for the Electoral College. And none of these legislative decisions could be reviewed even by their own state courts. Now, today, Republicans have 30 states in which they control both houses. This could set a precedent for presidential elections, allowing state legislatures to choose electors despite the popular vote. It is terrifying to think that after the 2020 election and all of that, that by installing state secretaries of state and state legislatures, that this truly could be a case of stealing the election.
The public approval rating of the U.S. Supreme Court, following the overruling by the court of Roe v. Wade, fell to under 30%, and some polls down as far as 25%. More and more, the unelected lifetime justices of the Supreme Court, the third branch of government, seems to have more power than either the legislative or executive branch of government, reminding me of what you started off this interview reminding us of in terms of what the founding fathers had in mind when it came to the Supreme Court. Aren't they now, in fact, operating pretty much in a legislative fashion for all practical purposes?
I'm very concerned about judicial overreach. The history of the court is stained by periods when the court, either through judicial restraint or judicial activism, has either failed to protect constitutional rights or has actively overturned laws or policies that protect constitutional rights. I do believe the court has a duty to exercise its authority in favor of expanding constitutional rights. So I don't think it's a case of judicial restraint or judicial activism. They need to view the Constitution the way a wonderful Justice William Brennan viewed it, as a living Constitution. And I'm very worried that this supermajority is going in the opposite direction.
Steve, in light of what you've just said so far, would it be fair to say that David Leonhardt, the author of the New York Times article on how the Supreme Court is a threat to what's left of American democracy, be correct? Has the Supreme Court in recent years acted as a de facto super legislative branch of the government? Has it served to deny to the American people the legislative measures that a great majority of Americans support?
Here again, I think we have to be cautious about insisting that the Supreme Court follow the will of the majority. During our history, majorities have supported slavery. Majorities have denied rights to women, people of color, and LGBTQ communities. The purpose of the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment is to place certain decisions involving fundamental constitutional rights of the kind we find in the First Amendment and other portions of the Bill of Rights, including a woman's right to choose whether or not to give birth. We've got to place those beyond majorities and legislatures. So once again, it's not one size fits all. There is a fear that the court must uphold those fundamental rights, and in some cases, if a legislature has banned abortion, then they do need to strike that legislative judgment down because it denies fundamental rights.
Well, given that the ultra-conservative makeup of the Supreme Court is likely to be with us for years and years, what do you believe, if anything, can be done or should be done to rein in the gross abuse of its intended role?
I think we have to take a real serious look at term limits and age limits to rotate and rejuvenate the justices' terms inside the United States. Do you know that we are the only major constitutional democracy in the world that has neither a retirement age on its highest court nor fixed terms for high court justices? 27 countries, many constitutional democracies that would come to mind, have term limits. President Biden appointed a presidential commission on the Supreme Court. It rendered a preliminary report last December. It offers the idea of staggered 18-year terms, which would assure each president would appoint two justices in any four-year term. I think those reforms, we don't need to pack the court, because if a political party hostile to constitutional rights ever maintained control for several years, they would pack the court with conservatives. I think term limits and age limits are serious. I know that Barack Obama recently spoke to that, and many others have.
Yeah, I agree. We're coming down to the end of our allotted time, unfortunately, Steve, but I wanted to ask you two things. One, in a nutshell, your last thoughts, and secondly, how can people find your writings and follow your work?
Well, you're very kind. Look, the Supreme Court, as presently constituted, is as much a political branch of the federal government as the executive and legislative branches. The presidents we elect, the senators we elect, nominate and approve justices. If we want to change the Supreme Court, we need to elect presidents and senators who support justices, who believe in a living constitution that follows evolving standards of decency that mark a civilized society, in the mold of Justices Earl Warren, William Brennan, Thurgood Marshall, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and the three liberal women on today's Supreme Court. I think we have to see the Supreme Court as much of a political issue in these coming elections, because we're electing senators who approve and consent Supreme Court justices, and in 2024 we have to take all of these issues into consideration. I'm always so grateful when you have me on your show. Many of my book reviews and articles can be found at lareviewofbooks.org/contributor /Stephen-Rohde, and that's R-O-H-D-E, and I'm always happy to hear from your listeners.
Yes, and Steve, and our listeners, I know, are happy to hear from you as well, and we thank you so much, really, for joining us today again on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, guys. It's my pleasure.
Thank you, Steve. Take it easy.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. You can get the show on there. You can ask questions. You can email us. We want to hear from you.